Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are there so many out-of-work lawyers in America today, and why are the ones who do have jobs so often dissatisfied? As a number of major law firms struggle to increase profits and retain even those who've achieved partner status, some studies find rates of alcoholism and depression among lawyers far exceed national averages. Meanwhile, U.S. law schools are turning out graduates at the rate of 45,000 a year, even though the Bureau of Labor Statistics only expects about 74,000 new lawyer jobs to be created this entire decade. So who's to blame for what has gone wrong, and what would it take to improve the situation for those affected? Stephen J. Harper spent 30 years as a litigator and is now adjunct professor at Northwestern University School of Law and Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences. He's a regular contributor to The American Lawyer as well. His new book is called The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
You tell us that when you applied to law school in the mid-70s, money was not your primary motivator. Do you feel like the story is different for a lot of today's students?
Well, I guess let me clarify what I mean by that. I think it is in this sense. I think that most people who decide they want to go to law school, it was true then and I think it's still true now, don't go to law school because they think they're going to get rich or go there because they want to make a lot of money. There may be some who do that. They're woefully mistaken if that's their motivation, because although the median income of most lawyers is better than the median income of workers generally in the United States, it's not the gigantic numbers that people see in the newspapers. At least when I was an undergraduate, the thought process was something along the following lines. If you wanted to get rich, go to business school. If you wanted to be a professor of some kind, go to graduate school. And if you wanted to do just about anything else, go to law school. So it also became a default solution for many undergraduates that couldn't decide what to do next. But now it's become a pretty expensive one.
And it was a default solution certainly for a lot of people who graduated with undergraduate degrees in this last recession.
Well, it's been a disaster for many of them, and you cited the numbers. And just last week, actually, there was the most recent numbers that came out from the ABA. Last year, that is in June of 2012, we graduated the most ever lawyers in this country, over 46,000. And the employment statistics for them, and by that I mean those who were able to get full-time, long-term, meaning lasting more than a year, jobs that require a legal degree, 56%. So it's a grim picture, and nobody thinks it's going to improve anytime soon.
And 85% of them graduate with about $100,000 in outstanding debt.
That's right, home mortgage without the house. And it's a terrible cycle, because a lot of that is happening because law school tuitions have gone through the roof. That's happening because at least in substantial part, they're all competing to continue moving up the U.S. News rankings. And anyone who takes a close look at the rankings methodology would immediately conclude that they're idiotic and no one should even be paying any attention to them, but nevertheless they rule the world. And then sort of backstopping all of this is federal money, because the federal government guarantees virtually all student loans. They're very easy to get. And, of course, once you have them, they're impossible to get rid of, because you can't discharge them in bankruptcy.
Yeah, and that did not used to be the case. But a few years ago, when they made changes to the bankruptcy laws, it was decided that student loans should sort of stay with you forever.
Yeah, they've had an interesting history. Originally it started out in the 70s, because people were concerned. There was no evidence to support it, but there was anecdotal stuff. And, of course, that got enough attention that people kind of went crazy, notwithstanding the evidence to the contrary. And the anecdotal fear was that people who came out of law schools with degrees that would lead them to lucrative positions would then immediately declare bankruptcy and leave the federal government, which was funding many of those loans, holding the debt. There was never any good reason for it. There was never any data to support that fear. And then over time, it started out really as a situation where after 5 years, if you could show undue hardship, then you could get out from under the student loans. Then it was expanded to 7 years, and then it was expanded to forever. And then just most recently, that is back in 2007, it was expanded to pick up private lenders as well. So, and it's a bipartisan, there's not a single political party to blame for this. It's been bipartisan disaster. in terms of the different presidential administrations going back to 1976 that are responsible for it. But the untoward consequences land on students.
So are law students actually sort of subsidizing other expenses for the universities they attend for law school?
You know, that's a really interesting question. There has been a fair amount of discussion and debate about that. You can't really get at the numbers in terms of private institutions, but there was a big controversy last year involving a public institution, and the data that came out of that one was that, at least at that point, the law school was returning about 30% of its tuition revenues back to the university. And so one of the problems, frankly, and if people who have followed this already know, law school tuition has doubled in the last 10 years. And back in the days, you know, 30 years ago when I was going to law school, it used to be just accepted that, you know, of course it would cost more to go to medical school. It costs way more to train a doctor than it does to train a lawyer. That's almost a common sense proposition. But tuition at most law schools now exceeds the tuition of medical schools. And that's because they are, for many of these places, they become profit centers.
All right, so let's talk about those U.S. News rankings. First of all, how did this become the sort of be-all, end-all of school choice and preference for so many people?
You know, that's a really good question. I think it has to do with what has become a cultural obsession for all of us. And it's apropos of the title of your program, Think. You know, if people can go to the comfort illusion of a numerical solution, then they don't have to think. Hmm. And I think that the ranking, and they take lots of different forms in lots of different spheres of life. You can go to hospitals, you can go to anything. You can find, you know, sort of rankings fixations. And the problem with it is, and how it gained currency, I'm not exactly sure, but it started in 1987 when U.S. News and World Report ranked initially the top 20 schools. By the early 90s, they were ranking all of the accredited law schools. And then it just became a sort of an arms race to who could keep moving up. And it wouldn't necessarily be a disaster, except that the underlying methodology is so terrible that it encouraged all sorts of perverse behavior. I'll give you an example, talking about the tuition point. One of the criteria for U.S. News rankings is expenditures per student. Well, it doesn't take into account at all whether the money spent on the student does anything to enhance the value. So, great, you've built a wonderful new library or a wonderful student center or something else. Expenditures per student go up. Your U.S. News ranking goes up. How does all that happen? Well, at the end of the day, it happens in large part because students who take out loans have to fund them with tuition dollars.
Hmm. And okay, so people might look at the sort of numbers and the way that those can be adjusted and say, well, that's unfortunate. But at least there is this a major component of the ranking has to do with asking law professors and asking professionals at big firms and judges about how they view law schools. Can you talk about what you've learned about that?
Well, that's really dumb. And it takes two components. What you're referring to is what the U.S. News calls quality assessment. 25% of a U.S. News ranking score depends upon a survey that they send out to four representatives of every law school in the United States, every accredited law school, the dean, the dean of students, the most recently tenured faculty member, and a fourth person whose name I can't remember. But the long and the short of it is you get this list of literally 200 law school accredited law schools. Each of these four people in every law school gets this list. And then you're supposed to rate the school, every school, all 195 or 200 of them, on a scale from 1 to 5. Well, it doesn't even matter whether whoever gets and completes that survey has ever set foot on the campus of the other law school or knows anything about any of the other law schools. They can put in a don't know response, but it's nuts. That's 25% of the ranking. And even more bizarre is another 15% that's a quality assessment of some unknown, undisclosed sample of lawyers and judges throughout the country. They do the same thing on a scale of 1 to 5, rate every single law school in the country. And I've been studying law schools for a long time. I couldn't rate more than 6 or 7 of them, and then most of that would be based on anecdotal experience. But even to take that as an example, the response rate on the so-called assessment by judges and other lawyers, the response rate for the survey is 12%. I mean, you wouldn't pay any attention to that. No statistician in their right mind would pay any attention to anything that goes on in the rankings. But that's almost half of the total ranking is this nebulous quality assessment, which is really just more a reputational component. It's really an exercise in how well schools have been able to brand themselves.
Yeah, so if you were to throw in a school that didn't have a law school, is there any evidence that that it would still be ranked a certain way?
A school that didn't have a law school.
There's been a sort of a check on this sort of ranking, and it's been found that if you put down the name of an institution, for example, that doesn't have a law school at all.
Oh, yes. There was a survey. Somebody did that. That was even more interesting. Somebody did a survey, and it just shows you how dumb some of this stuff is. But somebody, just to test the proposition that people are reacting to name recognition rather than to underlying quality, the judge who founded a law school in Michigan called the Cooley Law School back in the 70s or maybe it was the early 80s sent out a survey to a number of lawyers, I'm not sure what number, maybe 100 lawyers in the Midwest, asking them to rank half a dozen schools, and among those that he put on the list was Penn State. Well, at the time he sent the list out, Penn State didn't have a law school, but it came back in the middle of the pack in terms of being above some schools and below others. So there you go.
Okay, so all of this is frustrating, and maybe tuitions are high, but people might imagine, okay, well, as long as I can get a good job when I get out of school, it's worth it. And that is something that schools, law schools are very big about advertising about themselves, and they will give prospective students lists of their students who have graduated and gone on to big jobs. Can you talk about the way that those figures can be skewed?
Well, here's the problem with that stuff, and it's only as of last year that for the first time the American Bar Association required law schools to be a little more precise about what they mean when they refer to somebody as being quote-unquote employed, because up to that point you could be a greeter at Walmart or a barista at a coffee shop and you would count as employed. It included part-time jobs, short-term jobs, jobs that didn't require a law degree. And that's how, going in, well into 2009, the overall industry was able to report employment rates, quote-unquote employment rates, of over 93%. Well, starting last year, the ABA said, in response to some of the uproar, what's going on here? Because, you know, every time you turn around, there are students who, graduates who can't get jobs. And so now they have to disclose, schools have to disclose, whether it's a long-term, full-time job that requires a legal degree. And when you start including all those, that's how you get down to 56% 9 months after graduate. I mean, it's been an outrage in the sense that you had lots of law schools, and it's the height of cynicism, but lots of law schools who were putting new graduates on their payrolls for short periods of time just so they could count them employed on February 15th, which was the critical 9 month after graduation date for being able to call your graduate your new alum employed for purposes of the U.S. News survey. Now at least ABA has required you have to disclose that if you're putting a student on the payroll.
Stephen J. Harper is my guest. He's adjunct professor at Northwestern University School of Law and Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He spent 30 years as a litigator and is the author of The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. Join this conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Stephen J. Harper, who's an adjunct professor at the Northwestern University School of Law and spent 30 years as a litigator with a major firm. His new book is called The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here, Stephen, from Dormand, who asks about startup law schools. Dormand asks, is there any hope of their grads getting good jobs for the first decade after graduation?
Pretty good question. And the answer probably is it depends. I sort of continue to be baffled that in light of what's been going on, and it's a continuing growth of this lawyer bubble, I truly believe that, that law schools continue to come online. We've added, I think, 15 in the last 10 years, and there are a number of others that are waiting in the wings. The reason I would say it depends is because you have one law school, for example, University of California at Irvine, which just recently got going, and it has had as its mission to sort of crack into the very top echelon of top law schools. And so I think if it succeeds in doing that, the people who are in the top 15 or 20 or 25 law schools are doing pretty well in terms of being able to find jobs. But that leaves an awful lot of others that aren't doing nearly as well.
Is adding a law school a sort of sign of status for a university?
Well, I think it was, and I think for many of them, perhaps it still is. It's baffling, though, and if you look at it from the standpoint of what you think a university ought to do, at least now, in terms of any kind of consideration of larger social objectives or social welfare, if you're going to build a law school and wind up effectively generating, after you've taken lots of money from them, generating a number of new lawyers who can't get jobs, you really wonder. It's almost an intergenerational kind of antagonism, I think, in some ways, some of these developments.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Omar in Dallas. Hi, Omar.
Hi, how are you doing today, Ms. Boyd?
Great, thank you.
Hey, fan of the show and first time calling in.
Welcome.
All righty. My question for your guest was, where do you see the bubble in the future? I know you spoke about the student loans not being able to, you can't file bankruptcy on student loans anymore. So I guess people in this generation of school are going to have to be creative with how they pay off that off. They're going to have to pay it off now. So what type of things do you see happening for, like, people in the education in the immediate future?
Sure. That's a really good question. There are some escape hatches. For example, there are now income-based repayment programs that are available that provide some relief. The problem with those programs is they require you to commit for a long period of years. It's 10 years for public service and either 20 or 25 years for income-based repayment generally in terms of having low-income jobs and then basing the amount that you have to pay each month for your student loans as a percentage of your total income. The problem with it is that during the time that you're in those programs, your interest can continue to build. So the minute you drop out of a program like that, you can wind up with a bigger bill than the one you started with. I have not given up hope that the day will come when there'll be an ability for educational loans to be discharged in bankruptcy. Right now, they're in a category that, as we've been talking about, really. It's a category it doesn't belong in. The only other kinds of things that you can't discharge in bankruptcy are child support, alimony, certain kinds of criminal fines and penalties, and taxes. And if you ask yourself, why do educational loans belong in that basket, you have a hard time coming up with an answer that makes any sense. The other thing that would go a long way towards solving the problem, and this is going to be a much tougher thing to accomplish, would be to simply put law schools in a greater position of accountability so that when they wind up with large numbers of students who cannot find jobs that they need in order to cover their student debt that they took out in order to pay the law schools, it would be awfully nice, for example, and in my dream world this would happen, if a student had to go through bankruptcy and was able to discharge the loan, wouldn't it be interesting to see what happened if all of a sudden the federal government, which is the guarantees all of these loans, could come back at these law schools for recovery of those dollars. I think that would change behavior a lot. But your caller is exactly correct that there is a very large group of of young lawyers, young law school graduates that are really caught in the middle of a very tight vice right now.
How high up do you have to be in class ranking to be sort of guaranteed that you will find gainful employment upon graduation?
Well, some of it depends upon what the gainful employment is, and some of it depends upon the school you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're coming out of Harvard or Yale or Stanford or any one of the top 10 or 15 law schools in the country, your odds are overwhelming that you're going to be able to get a decent job with your legal degree.
Even in the bottom half or tenth of your class.
Sufficiently undesirable, I suppose. You can make yourself sufficiently undesirable even from those places that it becomes a little more difficult. But the employment rates, even on the most recent numbers of all those very top schools, are really quite good. Once you drop down into sort of the next group, and I hesitate to use law school, U.S. News type rankings, in order to make these judgments. In fact, I wouldn't. But you could generally group law schools according to sort of generally accepted assumptions about the quality of the school. And I would say there's a top group, sort of a second group, maybe of near top group. There's a larger middle group, and then once you get down into the the bottom third of law schools, it becomes more difficult. But a top graduate, even from a less highly regarded law school, if you're at the very top of your class, you'll have a decent shot. Below that, it becomes much more difficult, and that just doesn't seem like it's going to change anytime soon.
For those who do finish well or graduate from a top-ranked law school and they get those few coveted jobs at the big firms, this at one point was sort of appeared to be the ticket to not just a lot of compensation, but a really satisfying law career. And your sense is that this has really changed in the past decade or so.
Yeah, we've stumbled into part two of my book, which
right.
you're correct. You're absolutely correct about. And it's the same kind of affliction in a way. That is, it's the problem of using short-term thinking and focusing on short-term results and deciding there are a handful of metrics that are really the only things that you should focus on, even if they cost you longer-term values. So I'll give you an example. In the world of large law firms, which are regarded by many as sort of the elite of the of the profession, and that may be a debatable proposition, but that's certainly where most of the top graduates of the top law schools start their careers. Even though they're only about 10 to 15% of the profession, they exert an enormous influence over them, so you got to pay attention to what happens. And in those firms, the analog to the U.S. News ranking, I think, emerged in 1985 when the magazine that I now write for, The American Lawyer, started publishing average partner profit information for law firms. That was normally, highly closely guarded secrets. In polite company, people weren't supposed to talk about how much other people made. When these rankings began, which indicated for the top initially 50 law firms in the country what their average partners were, profits were, or what their gross revenues were, it fueled a new kind of race. Lawyers tend to be pretty competitive people, so you give us something to compete about, and we're going to do it. And as a result of that, there's been, I think, an evolution that's taken some time. But in the last 10 or 15 years, I think it's really accelerated, and even more so, really, in a way, with the Great Recession, of trying to maximize short-term profits, but at the expense of longer-term values like collegiality and mentoring and community and even, in some cases, institutional stability.
Well, in defense of The American Lawyer, clearly it's a great way to sell magazines, especially if you're publishing information that nobody talks about in polite company. But obviously there must have been, particularly in the beginning, people very surprised to learn that they weren't earning what their colleagues were earning.
Well, that was the other piece of the puzzle, because even, within many of these institutions, what your other partners were making was a closely guarded secret. Indeed, in some firms, it still is. But all of a sudden, you entered this. The world became one in which you could, pick up a magazine and you could see that, partner A over at some other firm, even if he was just a quote unquote average partner, because you couldn't get detailed information, was making this and you were making a little less, and so all of a sudden it became, well, let's listen to what they have to say over at that other firm. Maybe I can do better there. And when money becomes the glue that holds an institution together, it can become pretty tenuous.
So talk about how, in the short term, any particular law firm would try to boost profits. I mean, there's only so much business that comes in the door. So how do you get more money out of the clientele that you have?
Sure. It's a simple formula. You got essentially a three-legged stool that leads to profits for the equity partner owners. One is billable hours. That is the hours that you bill to a client. More is better. Which, of course, is the opposite of what you and I might refer to as productivity. You'd never say, gee, I'd like you to paint my house. Take as much time as you possibly can, and I'll pay you by the hour.
Yeah, you tell me what it costs, exactly.
Right. So that's one. So you have the billable hours is one leg of the stool. The second is the hourly rate, and those have been the hourly rate you charge for an hour is those have been, you know, moving up very, you know, almost without interruption. Even during the Great Recession, they didn't really come down, and now they're moving back up again. And then the third element of the stool that leads to partner profits is something called leverage. And leverage is simply the total number of attorneys you have in a firm divided by the number of equity owners that you have in a firm. So the more people you have on salary, for example, as either associates or non-equity partners, the higher your leverage. And that's pretty simple to understand if you think about it for a little bit. You could pay your salaried people, you know, let's just take a number and say $150,000 a year. But if I can bill out that associate and he'll generate or she'll generate 2,000 billable hours at $300 an hour, that's $600,000. So that's not a bad markup.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do that enough and you have what winds up looking like a pyramid with the equity owners at the top and then all the others at the base. Now, that's not necessarily a bad structure, except the problem is that over time, in order to maximize all these different those three metrics that I just talked about, all with the idea of increasing average partner profits, what firms have been doing as a group, big firms as a group, have been essentially pulling up the ladder on the younger generation. So it now takes longer to become an equity partner. Fewer people make it. Leverage has become higher, which means there are fewer equity owners per relative to the firm, and meanwhile you keep squeezing more and more billable hours out of people because that's the way you can increase your revenues.
So. And this is so fascinating to me, Stephen, because I think there may be a lot of people in our audience thinking, well, I want to feel sorry for the sort of junior associate making $200,000 a year, but it's tough.
Can't do it, right?
But there are a lot of studies that show, and there was actually a study recently of Harvard students that said they asked them, do you want to make $100,000 a year or $50,000 a year? And it would seem obvious that what you'd want to make is $100,000, but it's all about comparing yourself to other people. So with those associates making $200,000, look at the junior partners and the senior partners making five times that amount, then they become really dissatisfied.
That's part of it. Although there's a part of it too that has to do with the nature of the experience that many of those junior partners have. And I should always qualify what I'm saying too in the following respect. Not all big firms are alike.
Right.
There are major differences among firms in terms of their culture and in terms of how they conduct themselves. And indeed not all of them even function with this leverage model that I've described. The other caveat I should throw into this thing is that I come very much from a satisfied positive. You may find this hard to believe, but I had a great career, and I think it's a noble profession. You know, this book that I've written, I think I regard as kind of a tough love missive more than anything else. But the difficulty is that because of the pressure of high hourly rates, the kinds of, particularly in big firms, the kinds of work that can support those sorts of high rates winds up being, you know, gigantic kinds of disputes and cases. And smaller matters, you know, the first couple of cases that I tried when I was a young associate at Kirkland & Ellis were small matters that involved, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars of claims by one party against the other. And those cases, I got to handle those all by myself, and I got to try them all by myself, and they were extremely rewarding and extremely satisfying. Problem is that the high hourly rates that firms now command, it's no longer cost-effective for them to take those sorts of things on. So some of it, too, has to do with the kind of work that's left for the young associates in the bigger, gigantic cases. The other part of it, too, is, frankly, We were talking about before, you know, students that undergraduates sort of default their way into law school. And I think what happens, too, is a failure of expectations. You know, people, you watch The Good Wife or Law and Order, and if you think you're going to grow up and be a character in one of those in one of those episodes, you know, the actual practice of law doesn't have very many of those sorts of things that happen on a regular basis. So I think
you mean like boozy lunches and inter-office affairs? Or
that would be two examples. and another would be the associate, you know, Alicia Florek as a second-year associate doing the searing cross-examination that wins the case at the end of the episode. So I think that there's also what contributes to dissatisfaction among young lawyers. I don't think it has so much to do with looking up and seeing, well, these other people are making more. That's really not that's not fair. I think it has more to do with, boy, this isn't feeling like what I thought it was going to feel like. And I think that's one of the reasons I started teaching 6 years ago, the undergraduate class I teach, which is just we don't do enough of what I call reality therapy that helps people to really reconsider their own confirmation bias when it comes to what they think being a lawyer will be. And you made the point as well. You know, you think you're going to go in and everything's going to come out great and you're going to get a job. You know, even students who look at the 56% employment number, prospective students, the vast majority of them will say, oh, I can easily be in that 56%.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just confirmation bias, which, as I say, burdens us all.
Stephen J. Harper is my guest. He's adjunct professor at Northwest University School of Law and Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences. He's also a regular contributor to The American Lawyer and author of the new book, The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. We'll take more of your calls and emails after this break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org. And you can also send a tweet to Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen J. Harper. He spent 30 years as a litigator and now teaches law. His new book is called The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Stephen, as a remedy to the problem of dissatisfaction, particularly among younger attorneys, you certainly recommend that we give them meaningful things to do and positions of leadership within their firms and organizations. You also talk about a mandatory retirement age for older lawyers.
Right. We had them for a while, and I think they were actually a really good way of exercising some sort of control. The difficulty with the current model, one of the other things that's happened is there's been an enormous and growing spread within equity partnerships themselves. So these are the people that have all made it, you would say, you know, under our model that we were talking about earlier. But now there's a big spread from the bottom to the top, even within that group that made it. And the difficulty is, I think, that it's very difficult when you spend as much time and effort as it takes to become successful in any big firm. I think it becomes challenging for people to give it up. And I think that firms as an institution would be well served for the long run if they at least figured out ways to, encourage people to move on. Because if you're going to live with this model that's going to continue to limit the number of equity partners that you bring into the partnership, based on the people who are already there, then you got to figure out some way to make room for them. And it's sort of counterintuitive in a way to say, well, gee whiz, isn't 80 the new 65? And the answer is it shouldn't be for a healthy legal law firm anyway. It's one way that I think you could at least have some sort of a safety valve that would prevent people who really are strongly embedded and in control of the situation and their firms from just hanging on in ways that disadvantage the institution for the long term.
Do people who are pushing back against that idea instantly point to the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, they could, but that's another conversation. But you know, the thing of it is, there's nothing about a for-profit institution like a law firm that ought to be considered as analogous in some way to what the U.S. Supreme Court does. I don't think any partner in any law firm ever thought that they had lifetime tenure. I think a lot of them think that they live in a continuing state of probation, particularly at the low levels. But at the high levels, they have tremendous capacity to embed themselves. So you would say, for example, even to use the Supreme Court analogy, if there were another group of judges waiting in the wings, you know, immediately below within the institution, like a sub-Supreme Court, you'd say, well, how are we going to figure out some mechanism to transition that younger group into positions for the older group? And we don't have that system. But if you did, I think you'd probably say, well, in that circumstance, maybe we should have mandatory retirement for Supreme Court justices.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Tyler on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Tyler.
Hi. I'm a second-year law student at SMU here in Dallas. And before I went to law school, I spoke with a lawyer friend of mine and mentioned that I was going to law school. And he said, congratulations, it's the best business degree I know of. And so I think there's a sense out there that the law degree has a great value outside the legal field. And I found that to be true in interviewing for internships and other positions here in Dallas. But when I look at the business education and the law education, they are different. And one of the big differences is that law education is longer by a year. And here I am in my second year. I look at that third year, and I wonder what it's for. If, as we're told, law school is to teach you how to think like a lawyer, do we really need that third year? And I wonder if there are any serious proposals out there for shortening or reforming law school, which would in turn reduce the cost, as we've been speaking about.
Oh, interesting question.
That's an excellent question. If it were up to me, we'd eliminate the third year tomorrow and no one would ever have to do it, and I could even get my year back that I lost as a third-year law student. The problem with it is that most state bar requirements have imposed rules, or requirements, I should say, that essentially mandate an academic curriculum that takes 3 academic years to complete. And there have been a couple of schools that have tried accelerated programs, so they try to essentially jam 3 years of law school curricula into 2 years. But I think those are disadvantageous because that just winds up burying students and depriving them of an opportunity, I think, to kind of process what's happening as they go along. There's a third development that is a little more encouraging, and that is that increasingly in the third year, law schools are realizing that they've got to provide more practical kinds of experiences. So you're going to the world of what they call experiential learning clinics. You know, law schools always had legal aid clinics and that sort of stuff, but they're really moving further beyond that now into sort of more real-life kinds of opportunities and experiences, and I think that trend will continue. The difficulty is with all of this is, and I appreciate Tyler's point about the best business degree, but you know, if you want a business degree, then go to business school because you can get one cheaper, and it's a more direct route if that's really what you want to do. And you know, the problem is that all of this other innovative stuff in terms of the third year isn't going to add a single new job to the demand side of the equation. So it's good, I think, for people to be given, for law students to have a third year that feels a lot more meaningful than I think most third year students currently think they get. But at the end of the day, there's not a lot of evidence that it's actually leading to more employment opportunities for any of them.
So, Stephen, there was one extremely alarming study about lawyers and depression that came out in the early 90s, which has since been sort of re-examined and looked at. But what do we know about the differences between lawyers and the general population with regard to episodes of clinical depression?
Well, you're right. And back in the 90s, Johns Hopkins had published a study that had been done that essentially, to boil it down, says that the lawyers have about somewhere between 3.5 and 4 times greater likelihood of experiencing clinical depression than the rest of the population. There are a lot of sort of scientific and other criticisms that you could make of the study, but there have been plenty of other surveys since then that do tend to confirm that as a group, lawyers seem to be a sort of more unhappy than the general population. But again, here it's important also not to overgeneralize. So, for example, within certain types of practices, there's a dramatic spread in terms of career satisfaction. Surprisingly, or perhaps unsurprisingly, the lawyers who have the least career satisfaction, that is, the most unhappy lawyers, are in the biggest firms. So they make more money and they're enjoying it less. Those who are experiencing greater career satisfaction are in smaller firms, smaller to mid-sized firms, public service and government work, where they're making, you know, a fraction of what people are making in these other firms. So for me, it's a matter of each prospective lawyer, if that's where you're looking at, the way you want to look at it, trying to figure out where they fit in this spectrum of different things that being a lawyer can involve. And there's no right or certain path for anyone, but it's the statistics on unhappiness and substance abuse and depression are a cautionary tale that it's really important at least to try to get those decisions right, as right as you can at the front end.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Steve in Fort Worth. Hi, Steve.
I'm a lawyer in Fort Worth. I have two comments. One, I think most professions abuse substances at a higher rate than the general public. By that, I mean doctors are the worst, and the dentists, too.
Yeah.
Second comment.
Dennis beat us on suicide, by the way, if that's any consolation. I keep meaning to ask my dentist about that. But.
Second comment. I think politicians foster the creation of state law schools. And two cases in point. I went to Texas Tech, and a state representative from Lubbock created that law school in the legislature back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Second point, North Texas in Dallas, which opens up, I believe, next year,
right.
A state senator from Dallas fostered that law school. Perhaps a bit of self-aggrandizement. I don't know, but that might be a problem, too. Anyway, that's my comment. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Stephen?
It's a fair point. I have to wonder whether it's the most prudent use of taxpayer dollars in the current environment that lawyers find themselves in, and would-be lawyers find themselves, that what we ought to be doing is building more law schools. It does strike me as somewhat odd.
What kind of obligation do you think prospective law students have to really do their homework ahead of time, know what's out there, read between the lines, and not just sort of take the glossy brochure home to mom and dad and say, this is what I'm going to do?
I think a lot. And I think that the trouble is, you know, I've gone through the stage where you have kids, of having kids in their late teens and early 20s, and it's a very hard and disciplined exercise to do at that age, because you really do want to have a kind of a positive outlook on life, and you want to be optimistic, and you want to be all these things that make you young and ambitious. But at the same time, you do owe it to yourself to take a really hard look at it. And I think it's probably true not just for the legal profession. It may be more true for the legal profession than others, but I'd say the same thing for most young people. You know, take a hard look and figure out what you want your life to look like, and don't believe everything you read or see.
It does seem that law is a career that would be particularly hard to get into if one didn't have a natural passion for it.
Maybe, although you'd be amazed. I mean, if you put 100 lawyers in a room who've been out of law school, say 15 years or so, and ask them, well, out of 100 of you, how many of you went to law school because you couldn't figure out what to do next? I'll bet you'd get a show of hands that included at least half of them.
Hmm. So you can grow to love it.
Yeah, or something. Or maybe we just become so risk averse that we just settle in and then just sort of people just complain about how unhappy they are, too, which is a different kind of mistake to make with your life.
I think we have time for another call. This time we have Paula on the line in Dallas. Hey, Paula.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment, and this is really geared towards the bottom 50% of the law school classes who are, you know, unemployable or cannot find a job. I was an attorney and worked for a judge, and we had interns. And they seemed to be totally clueless about what the prospects for work were and a realistic outlook for how to get a job or just how to survive and hang out your own shingle. And I'm kind of wondering if any law schools are addressing that now. Maybe more preparation for being a single practitioner, or realistic assessments on the job market and how to survive until you get a job?
Yeah, a very good question. Getting realism out of law school deans is a challenge because it's counter to their self-interest, which is to fill their classrooms with students. But I have to say that a lot of them are getting better at it. And I think the one example is the move towards more practical third-year things and so forth. But what you're describing, Paula, is a colossal breakdown in the problem that you have when you don't have law school deans and administrators accountable for what happens to students after they get them in the door and start cashing their tuition checks.
I've not been to law school, Stephen, so if this question strikes you as ridiculous, please forgive me. But it seems like maybe we could reduce the cost of some of these classes, an element of this education. Maybe are there particular subjects that could be studied online or in different ways that didn't require a highly paid full professor to teach students?
Well, I have some skepticism about online, certain forms of online education in general, and I think law school would be a particularly tough one, especially the first year of law school, because it is, if you've ever seen The Paper Chase or read 1L, there's something unique that happens in the first year of law school that would be, it's hard for me to see how you could ever do that in an online setting. But your basic point is correct, which is there's absolutely no reason in the world for law school to cost as much as it does. If you think about being a doctor, okay, you can understand that. You need all kinds of equipment. There's all sorts of stuff that goes with being a doctor, and you can understand the need for that. But, tell me why I need a brand new, tell me in the age of the Internet, why somebody needs to be building a brand new library filled with books. Makes no sense at all. So and the cost piece, I think, that you could do some things with. But, again, where are the incentives to do it? It's a tough road.
Do you happen to know, are law graduates more likely to turn around and give large amounts of money to their universities than other graduates?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. My guess is that some are and some aren't. It sort of depends how they do.
Do you think this bubble will flatten itself out and resolve at some point?
I don't think so. Well, it will eventually, I suppose. You're just going to continue to have more and more unemployed lawyers around, and that'll create a different kind of problem. Where that all leads, I have no idea where it leads. But I'll give you the bubble's going to continue to grow. The current estimate is that as large as this year's law school class was, that is for the graduating class of 2012, 2013 is going to be even bigger. So in the face of all this attention and publicity and everything else relating to the problems of unemployed lawyers, you'd think you'd get to see some relief there. And maybe eventually we will, but the number of applicants still exceed the number of spaces available in law school, and the number of law school grow.
Stephen J. Harper is author of the new book, The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. Stephen, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.